I was told. Greg talked to me yesterday.
Okay, hi, Eric. Thank you.
It's like Las Vegas here, the Blue Man.
Exactly. Yeah. Good morning, colleagues. I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education. Today, we have two very informative and interesting topics before us that I'm very excited to hear. I do want to open with the caveat that given that it's week three, day two in the short session, the House floor starts at 10, which means both caucuses are meeting at 9:30. So we are gonna wrap it up by 9:30. So I think both of our presenting groups have gotten that information to kind of keep that you'll each get about half of the time. So I'm very excited to start our first informational hearing on summer learning, a particular passion of mine. And I would like to call Beth Unverzat. Close enough?
Pretty close.
You know when I say her name all the time? I work closely with Oregon Ask. Beth is from Oregon Ask. After school knowledge?
For kids.
Okay. After school for kids. They do extensive work, not only in Oregon, but are nationally, have a national reputation as great innovators and researchers on a whole range on summer learning, as well as after school time, CTE. They're great resources they're one of the many great resources we have on this state on summer learning, and I'm excited to have them here this morning.
Great.
So welcome.
Thank you so much. So for the record, I'm Beth Unverzat, Oregon After School for Kids. I live and our offices are in Wilsonville. And I'm deeply appreciative of the opportunity to be here and to talk about something that I believe after 40 years of watching Oregon education and participating in a wide variety of roles, that this is a missed opportunity. So that's really where we stand. We had a fantastic opportunity. You have a copy of this, a digital copy. So this is a report we wrote after the work group met last year. So this was published, and we have been spending time looking at it and thinking about it. We have a couple of other large projects that we are about to undertake over the next couple of years with some funding and access and equity survey of the state. So I imagine I will be back to see you. So let me see if I can actually do this with my...
You may be able to call Eric as a technology backup.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
For the good of the committee while we're waiting for this, I'm a big supporter of this program too, especially for that it includes students in poverty. I went to a NCSL conference where I think the number is like 60% of all kids learning is outside the school, where it's going to a library or to a camp or whatever. That's all knowledge learning outside the classroom. So having effective programs and being sure that the disadvantaged and underserved get to attend those is very important to me.
And just to thank you for that, Representative Wisnett. And also, you know, we talk a lot about the achievement gap. Well, much of the achievement gap is downright created, if not exacerbated, in summer, because kids learn at the same rates while they're in school. So much of that gap is either created or exacerbated in those summer learning times.
And the people that fall back are the disadvantaged
exactly
and the poor. This committee, we had the outdoor school, and remember they said they're going to come back and tell us how they're helping children with disabilities and the underprivileged, so look forward to that.
Very much so
technology is my friend.
Yes. Just keep telling yourself that.
I am. So okay. I'll just begin.
I think that's the wrong
he's going to find it. So really, virtually all of the advantage that wealthy children have over poor students is the result of differences in the way privileged children learn when they are not in school. America doesn't have a school problem, really. We have a summer vacation problem. So during the school year, resources are turned on for all students because of equal access to education. books, teachers, mentors, meals, enrichment and activities, and health services. During the summer, Fawcett is off. Limited flow of resources are available for summer, and it has implications. This year, we have seen across the country over 150 new pieces of legislation around summer learning. So the idea and the data that I'm going to show you right here is what has made a difference. So showing that low-income students fall behind 2.5 to 3 years by fifth grade. So, and it's cumulative. So I start behind and I stay behind.
Yep.
And that is a critical piece of the puzzle. So 51% of families not participating in summer say they would if they could. Families who pay for summer programs across the country reported a cost of $288 per week. Without summer counseling and support, one-third of first-generation college students fall victim to the summer melt. So they get through high school, but they don't continue on. We want them to continue on to either a work program or community college. So there are critical points of time and critical things that we believe can be done. And in 2014, only 1 in 6 youth eligible for federal summer food actually had access to it. And that is a huge problem here in Oregon, access to summer food. A third of the households.
Yes.
This is an issue that I've worked on for years, and trying to provide summer food programs for students. I wondered if there's coordination when you have summer learning programs with the summer food programs, whether they go together and how that works.
Some of them do, and we have seen an upsurge of cooperation between the state library and the child nutrition program. We also have sponsors that are school districts that are helping support it. But transportation is part of the problem. Kids can't get there. Some cities and districts do a better job than others, but kids can't get access. So Partners for Hunger Free Oregon has a fabulous map, and I would say they are working on it, but it is difficult to access summer food. So we, in this report, you'll see that we actually did a pilot where we looked at the schools that had low reading scores. And we looked at the school librarian association helped us tremendously. So we identified 141 schools that didn't have summer programs, and we asked them to keep their school libraries open and to give kids access to both food and to libraries. So they weren't close to a regional or a city library. So there are some very simple solutions that we can do with this.
Mr. Kocher.
Yeah, follow up. Several of us have been working on this transportation package. Huge transportation package will double the amount of transit availability, and including availability to students. So it seems to me that those students that live in transit districts, not all of them do, may have a better opportunity for transportation to and from these programs in the future. Mm-hmm. That's what we're hopeful for anyway.
Well, I'll be hopeful with you. Hope is my word for the year. And one of the other things is the increase in obesity during the summer months. And for students, minority students, it's twice as fast. So it's access to food, appropriate food. And we have waiting lists for youth jobs. So here's another thing that happens in the summer. So all of these things are combined and in the summer months. So here's Oregon. 27% of families in Oregon report at least one child in a summer learning program, but 45% report wanting their child enrolled in a summer program. We don't have enough programs. You know, historically, you'll come to May, you'll hear reports in the Oregonian and other places where people are complaining about the lack of access to programming. You know, I remember Senator Monroe meeting you in childcare years ago when we talked about the same thing, about the lack of access. But 80% of Oregon parents agree that summer activities helped their children maintain academic skills.
Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Director, what kind of fundraising program do you have? And to me, this is a great program if you'd have a campaign asking for people to buy a week of camp for a student and have that student write that person and say what it meant to him or something. If you can you comment on your fundraising?
So we are an intermediary. We're part of a national initiative. And we don't, so we
cannot
do research, write reports. We don't provide programs ourselves. We support those that provide programs. So our partners are Boys and Girls Club, the Alliance of Wise, the independent for-profit organizations, and the small community organizations. So we gather all of these people together.
So you're an advocate, but still, some way it seems to me that sounds like everyone's for this and realizes the value of it, but to be able to put a donation directly to a student would be...
And all of the organizations across Oregon spend a tremendous amount of time raising money. You know, I'm sure all of you have been asked by Boys and Girls Clubs and by others. And many, many of the licensed child care providers give scholarships. In enormous, so the Alliance of Wise, we're putting together a report on the amount of scholarships that are given by child care facilities to needy families. And that's in addition to ERDC. So, and parents here in Oregon spend $242 per week on summer learning, and 83% of Oregon parents support public funding. There's a map. That's what it looks like. So there are critical challenges. And so in our discussions that we had in the work group, these are the priorities around unique, high-impact programs. Too few students reading by third grade. I'm sure you've all numerous times had conversations about our low reading scores. High demand for remedial instruction during the transition years. So summer slide. And then low high school graduation rates. So engagement through work experience. So there are three parts to this this issue and ways in which those critical times can make a difference. So third grade reading. And then high school graduation into jobs. Pretty simple. So we believe that Oregon leaders should make every effort to achieve the following priorities. Preserve the gains of students. Why spend time from September through November relearning what you didn't learn the year before? When you learned it, you lost it, you try to learn it again. There's a, and it's really, it's one of the frustrations as a teacher to have six different groups within your classroom at different reading levels and promote equity so students of color and those from low-income families can advance in school and life by giving them the opportunity. So it's an opportunity grant. You know, it the opportunity for young people to actually participate in healthy activities. You know, we would all want to go to OMSI camp. Many of us can't do that. And engage communities, creating high-impact learning skills experiences. I have spent a lot of my life recruiting volunteers and engaging volunteers in the Smart Reading Program, 31 schools, 1,400 volunteers, and people care. People want to participate, but they have to be given an opportunity. They have to be given, you know, it's local control. Communities can come up with solutions if given some resources and some supports. So I really think that we have a missed opportunity here. And I'd be happy to answer any questions for you about our report. It's very detailed, very long. And any thoughts?
So I will start briefly because the work group that Beth referenced is one that I had put together and led. And what we put together was kind of what would be an ideal, you know, ideally, I think summer learning should be part of how we think about our education overall. I think we need to think about education 12 months a year, as opposed to the 9 months of the year that we focus on it now. And so we worked with a lot of community partners, everybody from migrant education through the Department of Education, school administrators, school boards, like she said, the Y, Big Brothers Big Sisters, Coalition Communities of Color. We did a kind of cast a broad net to say, okay, if we were going to do this, what would the ideal program look like? And a lot of the things that were mentioned today kind of were the key points on it. The idea of the number one thing being to have a community partner, that the most effective way to do summer programs is not to do a cookie cutter, do everything the same thing, but that to truly be successful, you need a community partner in all of these districts around the state. The second thing was to include food with it, that is just a critical element to that. And actually, I'm going to stop at two. I usually like to do three, but those were really the biggest top of mind in that work that we did. And Beth, I wondered if you could go back to the map, the Summer by the Numbers map, and just kind of talk a little bit about what this is showing and how you got to these numbers.
Okay, so the light ones have more summer programs, mm-hmm. and the dark ones have fewer. That's basically what the map is telling us. So, and we do not have enough of an accurate count of programs. So part of what we will be doing over the next couple of years is this access and equity survey. So we are looking at and identifying county by county what programs exist for what grade level, and do they operate in the summer or not. And so with the help of the Department of Education and some of the other major programs across the state, we should have really good, accurate numbers. I'm very fortunate. I have a couple of fantastic young people that are volunteers in Service to America who are learning GIS mapping as we speak. So we will not only have food sites on there, but we'll have everything else.
Great. Senator Roblin.
It's unique because it's not what you would expect. The rural counties have done better. Not better, but they're more represented here than they are in a lot of other
things. Yep. Look at how well Coos County is doing, for example.
Well, we have Big Boys and Girls Club, and we have a lot of activities, but and we used to have a lot that were through the schools, which we don't have at all anymore, so there's a lot of happening on. But I'm looking over at the far eastern part of our state and seeing some nice skill for stuff as well, which is, and it may be there's fewer people and they
yes.
do some stuff. But
some of it, yeah. Representative Lively.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So I'm just trying to understand. So what's you said this and I missed it. What's the criteria that you used? I'm trying to understand. So how did we set the number that are needed?
Well, if you look at the number of children and youth that are in Oregon, right now I can tell you there are about 91,000 in after-school programs. And so we did a national survey, and the numbers that we have come from that national survey, from a representative survey after school by three, where they did a subset for Oregon on summer learning.
So, I'm just trying to understand. So, I'm still confused. So, is this because all students, in theory, have this gap in the summer? Some it impacts more than others, but I'm trying to understand. So, what subset? Specifically, so this is students that are in after-school programs, or what
well,
subset
so,
of students?
Well, so students living in poverty. How many schools in Oregon have 50% or more free and reduced lunch? Let's start there, right? And then you can look at their test scores, and you can say, which ones where 60% of the kids can't read. Mm-hmm. I can tell you, there are 141 of them. We counted them. We called them. We talked to them. We did a survey of their teachers. So, you know, we can subset out all of this data and say you have there are targeted places.
Sure. Thank you.
Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. The question's to you.
Okay.
So I don't see recommendations. Is there recommendations and this is your report?
I will look at it too. So just to give you a little context for how we did this over the course of 2016 with the idea of trying to be cognizant of the budget situation that we were going into in 2017. And so what we decided to do was rather than come forward with a big proposal that we were unlikely to have the funding for, we wanted to see if we could get some agreement on overall what the problem was and how we wanted to structure it. And going forward, the goal is to, I think there are some recommendations in there, if I recall. I haven't read it in a little bit. But the idea is that I would say we have general agreement on the how, on the elements of community-based, being involved with food, and dealing with transportation. That was actually the third thing that indeed came up. Okay. And then the idea is whether we put together a pilot or something larger, that's what we would use this kind of baseline of agreement.
I think at the beginning, everyone on this committee, the comments made today say this is important. Go back to my statistics are right, 60% is outside the classroom. I think the chief education office should include this in their objective for education and put more emphasis on it. I don't know how we get the governor to do that or the chief education office to propose it to the governor, but I think that's part of education. It's not just in the classroom.
Yep.
And the data in you presented today supports that too.
And part of what we're the Student Success Committee, we are going to do some okay. investigating of summer learning as well and have that be part of the conversation. But I'm sure you will track it regardless. I agree with you.
We need to move it up in importance and putting it.
I agree. Co-Chair Monroe.
Well, this is a problem that, you know, educators have understood for a long time and been dealing with. I mean, we were an agrarian society 100 years ago. And so that's why kids got off school in the summer so they could work on the farm. I mean, that was just the nature of things. But even in rural areas that are predominantly agricultural, it seems to me that for kids under the age of 12, summer learning ought to be commonplace. You know, if high school students in a rural area need to have a couple of months off to help with the farm and agricultural activities and pick pears for Chuck or whatever, that maybe makes some sense. But third graders and fourth graders, strikes me that there ought to be lifelong learning opportunities for them.
Good point. Senator Roblin, and then I think we're right on schedule to move on to our next.
I just want to examine kind of what was said. When we did have an agrarian society, the 60% of learning outside of school was still happening. It just happened on the farms while the kids were working as mm-hmm. they on the farms. Because we learn regardless of where we are, what we're doing, it's doing things that makes a difference. And there was a really interesting book. I had an opportunity to go to MIT and do some work with our high school about learning. And one of the issues, one of the people there was talking about, there's a book being done back in about the 1940s. How did we get all the scientific breakthroughs we needed in the Second World War? Edgerton and Light, a whole bunch of deals that we did. And these scientists, the study said that there was no perfect golden bullet, nothing that you could say was the number one indicator. But the finding they did find was that more proportionately of the scientists came from farm families where dad told them they had to figure out how to make things work and mom was a teacher. At the end of the day, that was the thing that they came up with. These are the people that made the difference. And when asked, the scientists said, well, yeah, Dole told us we better figure out how to use the baling well to fix the equipment because we aren't going to buy anymore. And Mom said, get an education because you'll have to do that the rest of your life. So it was really an interesting thing. So those people in the space program, those other people, got the Mom's idea about getting the education and used Dad's idea of ingenuity to figure out how to do things. And it was really kind of a neat mix. So I think we forget sometimes that learning experiences in summer aren't necessarily, and in fact, much of the research would say, should not be the same as a classroom.
Absolutely should not be the same. So one of my recommendations is that we continue to work on this, that we look at other states, other legislation, what works, find the answers, create some templates that communities can use, give them opportunities for discussion. So, it's wonderful to be here, to speak with you, to talk about this issue, but it can't stop here because another summer will go by. And my dear friend, Superintendent Heidi Seib says, well, you've got to help them dream. And that's really what we want to do, is we want to give kids opportunities to help them dream about their futures. Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here.
Did you discuss your round school?
Yeah.
And also, like, three breaks instead of one.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Okay. We are going to move into the second presentation of our meeting. Juan Baez-Arevalo from the Office of Student Access and Completion at the Higher Education Coordinating Committee. Please come. Dais. No, this is the dais. Come to the podium. Senator Roblin.
I wanted to comment that before this meeting happened, there was another HEC person in the room, and they left when I told them we were going to ask them questions. So I haven't seen them come back.
Interesting.
We'll harass them later.
Mark Bird.
The three-month break is based upon people using.
There we go. Talks about.
Sure we are.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning. Thank you for the invitation. Just listening about summer programs, I started reminiscing and having good memories of the good old days. Both as a child growing up in a farming community and also as an elementary principal running and coordinating summer programs or making sure there were summer alternatives for the students at my school. Co-Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, distinguished members of the committee, for the record, my name is Juan Baez-Arevalo. I'm the Director of the Office of Student Access and Completion, OSNAC. It's an office of the Oregon Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and it's my pleasure this morning to provide you an update on our Oregon State grants and programs. Let's start with a review of the funding that we have for the programs. The Oregon Opportunity Grant for this biennium, we have an allocation of $145 million. And a noticeable difference from previous biennium is there's a larger proportion of lottery funds that has been allocated from the Education Stability Fund interest. For the Oregon Promise, we have a $40 million allocation for this biennium. The Oregon Opportunity Grant, as you know, is a first dollar program. It is for Oregon residents who are undergraduates and who demonstrate financial need. The awards are available for up to 4 years at full-time, full-year enrollment. And the awards are prorated for students who attend half-time and partial year enrollment. I should mention that the EFC limit, the expected family contribution limit for the Oregon Opportunity Grant, is currently at $3,500. Now, the Oregon Promise, as you know, it's for Oregon resident undergraduates who attend the community college at least half-time within 6 months of graduating or completing a GED, and the awards available is available to them for up to 90 college credits. The current expected family contribution limit for the Oregon Promise is at 20,000 EFC. During the last 9 months, we formed two advisory groups at OSEC to advise us as staff and in our office as to our programs. The first group that we gathered together is on Oregon Promise, and it's an advisory group of representatives of community colleges so that we can work out any details of nuts and bolts, improve our implementation and coordination with them, and get feedback from them in terms of and coordinate as well for information to students, the outreach, and the effectiveness in helping students access and succeed in the program. And then the second group is an Oregon Student Aid Advisory Group, which is a representative group of public institutions, private nonprofits, community colleges, and the Oregon Student Association. And this group is helping us take a look at the system of student aid in our state and where we're at, what are the needs, and helping OSAC reflect as we're looking to evaluate the programs and to identify the key areas of inquiry. And we've been soliciting suggestions, policy questions, and areas of inquiry from the financial aid community at large in the state. At a recent conference, we did a presentation, and we've asked them to give us areas of interest or gaps and needs that they see from their perspective as they interact with students on a daily basis. Well, let's take a look at the Oregon Opportunity Grant. As I mentioned, the Oregon Opportunity Grant is our need-based grant in our state. Think of it as a first dollar program, and it has no age restrictions, so you have recipients of all age categories, some returning to school, some starting school. The EFC limits previously were $4,000, 4,000 EFC. Currently at 3,500, as I mentioned, for this year. The award amount has remained the same. It's been flat at 2,250. The goal, of course, is to increase enrollment, completion, and affordability for Oregon students who have demonstrated financial need. And some of the information that you'll see today will highlight how that's being achieved. The eligibility for the Oregon Opportunity Grant is for Oregon residents who are citizens or permanent non-citizen residents or students who are eligible for in-state tuition under the tuition equity guidelines. And they must be undergraduate students and demonstrate financial need. You will recall there was a shift in the policy orientation of the program to have it focused on the neediest students, and the students with the highest financial need are prioritized through this program. Now, the number of students served in the last biennium, we had a total of 81,535 awards, and total funds to students were $136 million. Down below in the table, you'll notice that there is a comparison of the funding sources from the last biennium to this biennium. And I should note that the initial data that we have for the fall of 2017 is that 39,300 students will receive an estimated $68 million for this academic year. The distribution over time of this critical program, as you can see, there has been a shift, an increase of in terms of the disbursements by sector, and for community colleges in 2016-17, they received $33.9 million. For Oregon Public Universities, 32.6. Those are students at public universities, and students at private nonprofits, about $5 million were dispersed to them last year. The Oregon Opportunity Grants, it's clear that we have a gap. We have a funding gap. There's a great need, great number of eligible applicants who do not receive the award.
Yeah.
And as we prioritize the awarding to the highest need students, obviously there are students who are not able to receive the award from the Oregon Opportunity Grant. And it's in great part that there is demand, a very large demand. It's been there. It's been consistent. Oftentimes, especially in recessionary periods, you'll see a peak. But the gap continues to exist. And as you can see in this next slide.
Director.
Yes.
Could you back up for a second? Could I ask that you send to the committee that chart on page 10, but in percent, like give me a percentages. So there were this many applicants, this many recipients, which means X percentage of applicants became recipients. Because visually you can see it, and we can see that the gap is bigger now than it was in 07, 08, but not as big as it was during the depths of the recession.
Yes.
But I'm a numeric as well as a visual person, so I would appreciate that.
Certainly will.
Thank you. And Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. To follow up on that, what's the guesstimate on, you know, obviously the applicants mean there's less people going to college. It's they're close. You know, that's a big drop down. So what are we looking for? Is the number of students coming to college going down? Applicants, you know, we have to go through these, and the universities have a tough time, you know, build up for the, during, we had the big growth in the 2010, 2012 area, and now mm-hmm. we're down to, what is the projection? There are a lot of people, the governor's program about Oregon Get Ready, or future, ready for the future or something, talked about everyone doesn't need to go to college.
What you see here, this big increase, particularly 2010 through about 2014, is really the recession. So every time you have a recession, you'll see a rise in the number of individuals who seek to go back to school or may need to go back to school because they find themselves unemployed, underemployed, and the number of FAFSA applications rises tremendously. That number, of course, right now we are in a much better economic position than we were during the recession in terms of employment trends. But the gap in terms of the number of applicants versus the number of recipients continues to be there, even in a good time period, if you will, economic time period as we are right now.
I guess I'm looking for, thank you, Mayor Kutcher. This is my first time to sit on Capitol Construction, so I guess Friday we're going to be, and you know, the big demands or ask are always colleges, and you know, I forgot who it was, but must have been a smart person, told me, my wife was involved in building a church, and that you never build a church for Easter Sunday. And are we, you know, same thing when we start, you know, adding to structures and facilities at our universities, you know, are we, demographics is important, I mean, in everything we do. And so, you know, what do we see for the long range? Is it less people going to four-year schools, less people, more people going to community colleges? What?
Representative Wisnant, Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, that is a difficult question for me to predict given my position at OSAC, but I can share a little bit of what I can see. You know, we have a large number of adults who have not yet achieved a post-secondary degree or certificate. You still have students coming from the pipeline, from the K-12 system, that will need education and training. What we can see, there's a large number of individuals who have an interest in attending post-secondary education and that have need And in this table that you see here for 2017-18, you can see the number of eligible applicants with an asterisk. And that number looks to be different than the 2016-17 or the 2015-16 year. And it's simply an undercount, because our system, it's our system undercounting that number based on the fact that we focused on the lowest need individuals. So when we looked at the those individuals with, say, an EFC of 4,000, that would be about the number that you see there. Obviously, there's many more who have need, many more who have an interest. We have a changing economy, and all of us will need some retraining. We need to retool and continue to prepare ourselves and educate ourselves. You know, going to church on Easter Sunday, you know, that might be a once in a year event, but some of us are regulars. And so there is a need to have facilities and infrastructure in place for the regulars, not just for Easter Sunday. That would be my opinion.
Good response. Thank you.
So I'm going to go briefly to Senator Roblin, but I know the second section has a lot of details about the Oregon Promise as well that I'm sure we want to get to. So
yeah,
we'll...
and mine's a little bit about both. When it goes to eligible applicants in that previous one, we are now really doing a much better job of getting almost as many students as we can to fill out their FAFSA.
Yes.
And many of the kids that talked to me said, it's really exciting. I fill it out, and pretty soon they say, you only need one more document, and you will have finished up all the requirements for the promise. Or is the same thing happening for all of the people who, if you wanted to go into being a getting a recipient of OOG? Does FAFSA kind of tell you you've got all the stuff you need now, or you do qualify? Because I wonder if the eligible list mm-hmm. is equal to the people who really planned on going or not. You know, how close are we getting to those kids that on this chart mm-hmm. who really had always anticipated if they had the money to go, and those kids that I'm going to fill out the forms because everybody wants me to. Yeah, I probably qualify, but I wasn't planning on going the first year or whatever, even if I had got the grant. So do we know how are these proportions and these numbers pretty clear about meeting the needs of those that we can? I know we've each year lowered the what it, how much money your parents can contribute to keep that number close to each other. But do we know if that if just filling out the FAFSA gets you in these lists or not, or does it really do they have to ask for it to be considered a eligible?
Senator Roblin, Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, for the Oregon Opportunity Grant, completing the FAFSA is the key indicator to be considered. Okay. So you will look at that higher number, that 308,000
okay.
of total FAFSAs completed. We have had a campaign of guiding individuals to complete the FAFSA, primarily at the K-12 level. We have partners at numerous sites to do that. Many nonprofit organizations that have assisted us in getting students, particularly those most in need, because one of the biggest barriers to accessing higher education, any post-secondary education, is having the finances or the ability to do so. And completing the FAFSA is the first step to be considered for any eligibility. So yeah, the number is much higher, so you can see. But those eligible applicants that have completed everything, who have the need, as you can see, is still much larger than those that we're able to afford to give them an award.
And I just have to say briefly, I'm also struck by the difference in the FAFSAs filled out and the number that were viable. And that has dropped precipitously in the last couple of years. And right. But I'm just wondering, is that kind of a function? There, it's about the same number each time, roughly, yet you had about a two-thirds validity rate in 15-16, and then it drops to about 50% or less in the next 2 years. And I would say it might be a function of trying to get more people to fill it out, but when numerically it's about the same number as that first year, where you was that just a glitch? That it was that you had a high, you know,
Madam Chair,
that
I, would,
year?
I would love to be follow up with some additional details in terms of the FAFSA completions, the potential glitches that might be, the starts, because you may have individuals who start, whether they're coming from the K-12 pipeline or they're adults and then they decide not to, or they didn't complete it fully. They missed a section or they didn't provide something and they failed to follow up.
Great.
So we can give you more of that kind of information so that you can discern from volume to actual completions, and then the completion really shows that intent, the intentionality. And we've had good results in encouraging students coming from the pipeline to complete the FAFSA. That is a positive thing, because for many, without completing the FAFSA, they wouldn't have any financial support whatsoever to access post-secondary
And then education. As the person who talked about our time limits, Doug did just point out to me that we do have a light schedule on Thursday, so we can continue to kind of dig in this and finish it up, I think.
Parent,
it'll give you two more days to get us back some of that information.
Senator Rowland? Parent income is a big one that some parents don't want to give that.
Correct.
So the kid starts the process, and then they can't fill out that part.
Right.
So.
Yeah, and I totally understand that. And at the same time, it really is striking the difference in that
yes,
in
is.
That viability rate.
I agree. Well,
there's been situations that we've become aware of separated families where
one family member
doesn't want to provide the information and they need it in order to complete it, or students who may find themselves still dependent but really on their own. And so there's many different situation. So moving on, an example for you in terms of how the award calculations get processed. And this particular example you can see is for a student with that lowest EFC of zero of expected family contribution. And the difference between the remaining need, as you can see there at the bottom, for a student at a two-year public institution versus a student at a four-year private public institution, and the maximum award amount being the same. So one of the challenges with that we hear is a question of equitable purchasing power, whether or not a student at a four-year public institution has the same equitable purchasing power with that award amount. Clearly, with it being what it is, as flat and the same, they don't.
Can I ask, in that first line of each of those, that is your overall cost, including cost of living?
I was going to say,
because otherwise they would seem that, and I think that I just want to call that out, because a lot of times the focus is, community college tuition is so much less than public universities, but the cost of living is the cost of living regardless of where, of whether your tuition cost isn't that significant. It's really often more the cost of living is the cost of living.
It is the cost of attendance total.
Yeah, yes. And that standard share, is that what that?
That's the student's share.
Student's share,
so in the formula that we have, it's the student's share, and you can see there's a difference of student share between a two-year public institution and the student who attends a four-year public institution. And both, in this case, they're both Pell eligible, and you see the remaining need the students have.
So that's the assumed student share just outside of the FAFSA. So your family is not expected to contribute anything, but you are expected to contribute between $6,000 and $9,000?
Well, it's the students or the family, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's based on assuming that person is going to work X number of hours a week, and so that's what they come up with. The only thing that I would say with respect to community college is if you can stay at home, you can really cut your costs down. So having community colleges in more districts than we have universities, there is a significant advantage for kids, from my perspective, who live near a community college to take advantage of that.
Okay, go ahead. Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh.
It's 12,000.
So over time, I think it is important to reflect on how this program has been implemented and the directions and the models that's been have been applied in the state. The first section is the award on a percentage of cost of attendance by sector. So obviously the cost of attendance at a two-year institution, as you saw, is less than a four-year institution, and there's a cost of attendance difference between a public university and a four-year nonprofit. For a period of time in our state, we had an award amount that took into consideration those differences. We followed that change with the share responsibility model awards, and so you saw there that there was a student share, or this is the legacy of that share responsibility as well. And today we have an EFC, which is the highest, the lowest EFC, the highest need low EFC students. That's how we're prioritizing the program today. The award amount is flat, so there's no differences between any of the, regardless of the sector the student is attending.
Okay. So the next page begins a new section, and I would like to propose, due to excellent staff guidance, that we maybe ask any other questions that we have and then stop here and move to and hold you over till Thursday.
Okay.
If either you or some, I apologize for the short notice, but some other excellent designee. I'm going to start with Rep. Wisnett and then.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Director, when you come back to talk to us, and maybe Mr. Wilson, I don't know if this is Mr. Wilson or you, this is the Ways and Means Committee. And do we have a ballpark figure on what's the administrative cost of doing all this? How much are we paying to deliver that funds to the student in their bank account? Is that possible to look at that or talk about that?
Representative,
counting the universities and HEC and the whole system. I mean, I'm on a audit committee, joint legislative audit
clearly
committee, and we're looking at expenses. So we're talking about this much money. We know how much is
is it costing us to spend that money?
Yes.
Representative Wisnett, Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, we can certainly look at that from our perspective, from OSAC's perspective. You know, any limitations of that guesstimate would be identified best we can. I can say that the costs of administering the Oregon Opportunity Grant are fairly low, much lower than it is for the Oregon Promise, administratively speaking.
Yeah, when you come back on Thursday, I have a question. We've known for years that students who graduate from high school east of the Cascade Mountains are less than half as likely to go to college. I have some reasons why I think that's the case. I'd like you to verify that and see if we're making any improvement in that way. But we know that students whose parents are college graduates are much more likely to go to college than those whose parents never went to college. That's a factor. We also know that the fact that our students that are graduating east of the mountains are less likely to go to college means that overall, in terms of the economic viability of the state, that salaries and everything, jobs and everything else in those rural parts of the state are less than in the urban parts. So it does make a huge difference. And I just wondered if we're doing anything to, other than Aspire and some of those programs, to get more of those students whose parents never went to college, who are maybe the first ones to go to college and or not, to get them into our community colleges and our universities and filling out their FAFSA and getting their economic aid and so on. If you could speak to that a bit when you come back on Thursday, it'd be helpful to me.
So much homework.
I love the homework. Thank you very much.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you. I just wanted to, I had mentioned earlier that we had a nice heck person in the room before, and then they weren't here. They made it back. I am so proud of the fact that they were in the room in case we had any questions. But, and I would have been remiss for not mentioning them.
Okay. On that note, we are going to finish promptly and look forward to seeing you or your designee on Thursday.
On Thursday.
Thank you very much. With that, we are adjourned.
Cal, thanks for all the rubbing.
Thank you.
All that work he's got.